To order, we have a quorum.
I thank you very much, everyone, for attending. After our last committee meeting here, we closed out our minutes, so we have no minutes to approve today. So, with that, members, today we'll be hearing from both the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Department of Health regarding the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, called NARC, and the Office of Health Facility Complaints. We invited the agencies to come and talk about the process of how reports are made, screened, and if necessary, the investigation of the reports, and finally, the resolution process. First up is the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and good morning, Carrie, and you're going to represent and talk about Mark.
Yes. Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. It's a pleasure to be here today to provide an overview and a status report for you on the operations of the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center. My name is Carrie Benson. I'm the Director of the Aging and Adult Services Division within the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Within my division, I have the Adult Protection Unit. That unit provides support and oversight to the county adult protection teams around the state, as well as it provides oversight to the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, and that's what I will focus on today. The Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, and just for a little bit of an ease in presenting to all of you, I'll refer to it as the MARC throughout the rest of my presentation. But the MARC was established in July 1, 2015, to accept and make the required referrals of reports of suspected maltreatment of vulnerable adults. And the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, MARC, is available and able to accept those reports 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And you'll see here a list, the listing of the responsibilities of the MARC, and I will be going into those each in a little bit more detail in my presentation. I just want to highlight a couple things on this slide, though, so as just to provide a little bit of a refresher and background for all of you. In terms of a vulnerable adult and the scope of the MARC responsibilities, a vulnerable adult can be anyone over age 18 who has a physical, mental, or emotional disorder that makes it difficult for the person to care for themselves without help and to protect themselves from maltreatment. It can be someone who is in a hospital, nursing home, transitional care unit, assisted living, housing with services, board and care, foster care, or licensed care facility. Or this person could be receiving services such as home care, day services, personal care assistance, or other licensed services. And in terms of maltreatment, I also wanted to provide to you the definition of what is encompassed in maltreatment, because it can take many different forms. It can include abuse, including physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. It can include neglect, including failure to provide necessary food, shelter, clothing, health care, supervision, because of neglect by a caregiver, or because the vulnerable adult cannot meet their own needs. And finally, maltreatment also includes financial exploitation. So this includes theft or withholding of money or property, and or use of money or property not for the vulnerable adult's benefit. So just wanted to provide some of that grounding. And in terms of the establishment of the MARC, the Minnesota Department of Human Services, in partnership with the counties, saw the need for an easier way for people to be able to know how to report suspected cases of maltreatment. And it's very much based on suspicion of potential maltreatment. And so with the goal of encouraging reporting by the public, of course by mandated reporters, we wanted to establish a much easier way for those reports to be accepted. One number, one website that I'll go into here in just a minute, and really get away from the many, many different phone numbers and different availability of counties or other offices to take those calls in or those reports. And I think at one point before the mark, we had about 160 phone numbers, and now we're at the one number, and it's availability 24/7. What MARC doesn't do with reports that it receives about potential maltreatment is refuse to accept those reports. So the MARC takes all reports in and follows the same protocol in terms of processing those. The MARC does not screen out reports or make investigation decisions, and the MARC call center staff do not provide information and advice to callers. The phone reporting aspect of the MARC, again, available 24/7, 365 days a week, it's promoted as the way for voluntary reporters or the public, just really anyone, to use to submit a report of what they think might be maltreatment of a vulnerable adult. And so we've been really encouraging folks to use that phone number. Of course, we direct people to the MARC, who directs people to 911 if a crime is in progress or if police or ambulance are needed. But otherwise, the MARC then is available for those reports. And in terms of the reports accepted by the public, I just wanted to note that the reports are accepted with the information available to and shared by the reporters. So basically the MARC takes in all information with whatever maybe gaps are existing in that information or what have you. And we find that, you know, the reports are basically as accurate as information the reporter is providing. And so reports can involve people that aren't vulnerable adults. Reports can involve people that have been alleged to have done something wrong, who maybe did not, and incidents which are not maltreatment. But we take all of those in and follow a consistent protocol to then screen and refer those reports. The web reporting form is for mandated reporters, and I have listed here general categories of individuals, professionals who are considered mandated reporters, and we encourage mandated reporters to use this web reporting form to submit their reports. However, the MARC will accept phone reports from them also. What I don't have listed here is that financial institutions, even though they are not mandated reporters, may use a web reporting system also. This next slide provides an overview, very high-level snapshot of our weekly MARC phone activity. Again, as I mentioned, the MARC was launched July 1, 2015, and so you'll see that blue line shows quite a jump in calls and reports submitted to the MARC, and then that blue line has quite a bit of kind of ups and downs, fits and starts almost, I would say, as far as the volume of the calls. However, you'll see then with the green line, the red line is 2016, so that's a full year of call volume. And then the green line is the 2017 call volume. Those we see are kind of evening out a little bit, stabilizing a little bit. The beginning of 2018 is represented by the purple line. So we are tracking the call volume on a daily and weekly basis. In calendar year 17, the MARC received 57,180 reports of potential maltreatment of vulnerable adults. Those reports involved or included 80,666 allegations. So you'll see just by those numbers that any given report to the MARC could involve or could include more than one allegation, meaning more than one type of abuse that might be involved in that situation. And what you're looking at here as far as the percentages are the percents of the allegations that were received in calendar year 17 and listed in order of frequency. And so we see a significant or notable proportion are reports that are indicating that there might be caregiver neglect as a part of a potential maltreatment situation, followed by financial exploitation and self-neglect, both at 18%, and then that is followed by emotional abuse, physical abuse, and sexual abuse. In terms of the overall volume of reports, you'll see here that the calendar year 17 was at 57,180 reports, and that is an increase, a fairly steady increase from when the mark was first established. In 2015, there was about 51,000 reports, and then 2016, a little bit closer to 54,000. So we're seeing a gradual increase in overall reports. Here's a little bit more information about the allegations. These are numbers showing, you'll see from the previous slide that, or refer to the previous slide, that there were 80,666 allegations received in by the MARC in calendar year 17. So we have that total listed here. And then to the right of that on this chart are the number of allegations that were referred to each of the respective lead investigative agencies. The counties received a little bit over half of those allegations were referred to them, the county adult protection offices, so that's one of the lead investigative agencies. The Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Health Facility Complaints, received 35%, and the Department of Human Services Licensing Division received 11%. This is a diagram that shows that the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center is the common entry point, or what we commonly refer to as a single entry point for receiving the reports of potential maltreatment of vulnerable adults. It illustrates that whether the report comes through the online form or through the phone, the MARC receives those reports and then makes immediate referrals within 30 minutes of completion of taking in that report from the caller, or processing the online report then is also processed as far as immediate referrals. So in terms of the immediate referrals, depending on what the situation is, if there is allegation that might be connected with a criminal activity, law enforcement is notified. Suspicious death involves notification to law enforcement, medical examiner, and potentially the Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Ombudsman. If there's a risk of imminent harm, County Emergency Protective Services are notified. Here's a little bit more information on the trends for the MARC. We're just starting to be able to provide and really track this data in terms of trends, since the MARC has been in operation now for just over 2 years. So we're starting to see, you know, how will the call volume fluctuate, as well as other aspects of these, of the calls and the reports that we're getting in. So the notifications to law enforcement increased by 10% between 2016 and 2017. The notification to Emergency Protective Services decreased slightly, and that is due to work that the MARC call center, as well as my adult protection staff team, did with the county adult protection and emergency protective services staff around the state to really refine the protocol. So when we see areas where we can really tighten up the consistency, make some of those process improvements, we are taking those in and doing those as we can throughout the implementation of the MARC. So always looking for those types of improvements to really tighten up the consistency, but also, of course, the timeliness. As I said earlier, every report is referred to a civil lead investigative agency, And this slide provides information about the scope for each of these lead investigative agencies. So the Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Health Facility Complaints, receives reports that are involved, that are located in hospitals, nursing homes, involve comprehensive home care providers, assisted living, housing with services. So that's the scope of the reports that they do receive for follow-up then in terms of that investigative process. Similarly, the Minnesota Department of Human Services Licensing Division receives referrals of reports involving the home and community-based services providers and licensed providers that they oversee. In contrast, the County Adult Protective Services receive reports that involve that do not involve one of those licensed providers, of course, but involve rather situations involving maybe a family, friend, stranger, maybe it's a scam, maybe it is a self-neglect situation. So they receive all of those types of reports. The MARC call center works very diligently to make sure that they are referring reports that they receive as quickly as possible. And so you'll see here, these are the time frames that the MARC call center is able to meet and that we hold them accountable for through the contract that we have with the call center. So as far as the phone reports that come in to the MARC, those are referred to lead investigative agency or agencies within 30 minutes. The referral of the web reports is within 4 hours, and then the remainder of the slide shows that there's the within 30-minute referral. The statutory requirements for these referrals are within 24 hours for the Emergency Protective Services, law enforcement, medical examiner, and ombudsman. So we've really cut that time down to that 30-minute interval. So we are really always looking for ways to, you know, really streamline the process and get those reports moving as quickly as possible. And then similarly, as far as the referral, the statutory requirements for the referrals, it outlines the responsibilities within 2 working days to refer to the lead investigative agencies. I wanted to say just a little bit more about the MARC call center vendor. As I just had mentioned, the Minnesota Department of Human Services has a contract with a call center vendor to operate the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center. It's a Minnesota-based vendor that has experience in other healthcare-related call center functions, but they also have a variety of other businesses, companies that they perform a call center function for. They have 3 locations in Minnesota. The 2 of the locations, Marshall and in Hutchinson, are the locations where staff are located that are dedicated exclusively to answering calls that are coming in through the MARC phone line as well as processing the web reports. Again, there's 24/7 availability, 365 days a year, and a significant level of oversight by my team, the Adult Protection Unit. The oversight that is provided by my team through the contract with the call center really involves close working relationship and oversight to evaluate performance and ensure operations are consistent with the performance standards that are outlined in the contract. And this includes data monitoring and quality reviews of report entry, processing, and referral. So we have established these performance levels for the call center. We've established service levels as far as the staffing levels and availability. And we monitor those through daily contact and interaction with the call center, with the management team there, and And we address quality concerns regarding reports. We identify needs that maybe a particular call center staff person has, or maybe it's a broader need for training, education, around the procedures and the protocol. They get extensive training. The call center staff receive extensive training regarding the protocols that are laid out in detail in terms of how to take in the reports and make the referrals. We address on a daily basis technical issues and any impact those might have to service levels. And we respond to questions and inquiries from the staff themselves, from the call center, regarding reports that they're getting in. So we can really help them make sure that they're meeting those performance standards as far as timeliness. And then in addition to that, we have weekly meetings with them to review that weekly service level that I shared with you earlier, as well as the performance measure data that we track on a weekly basis. And again, you know, that might also lead to identification of training needs and procedures where we need to provide that additional support. We also conduct monthly on-site visits with the call centers in both of the locations. Those site visits and call include sitting with agents and listening to live calls, auditing calls with the leadership team, and they have a component of their leadership team focused on quality assurance. And so we meet with them after sitting through some calls and discuss the quality assurance procedures that they have in place and if any refinements might be needed. We identify and address gaps in the procedures or technical issues at that time, too, if they are identified. And then we review policy and procedures with them. Finally, we also do a quarterly review with the full team here at DHS, as well as with the contract management staff. And we review again. It's another time for us to step back and just take a look at the performance measures that we have in place, the service levels, the technology aspects of the work as well. Just do an overall review, but then also look at the cost, too, and really ensure that we're aware of if there have been any changes in costs for the call center, and then we adjust accordingly. This slide provides a little bit more information about the performance standards for the MARC. I had mentioned the fact that the staff receive a great deal of training, but really the quality assurance efforts of the MARC start even well before that with the hiring and onboarding of the staff. And they go through significant vetting and screening, each of the agents do prior to being hired, as well as getting a background check conducted. They make sure that they have on the team subject matter experts in particular service and policy fields that can help provide the background needed to make the intake and referral process in a high quality manner. And what they've really found is that they can have this dedicated team, staff that have really stuck with this and are very committed to performing this service in the highest quality manner. And so they have really continually refined their hiring process and how to really find those individuals that are a good fit for this work. And again, in terms of the quality assurance and training, there is a probationary period upon hiring of the staff. And again, the phone calls, while we are on the site visits, we listen to live calls, but then while we're not on site with the call center, we listen to recorded calls on a regular basis, identifying any quality assurance concerns that we have and addressing them immediately with the call center. And as I mentioned, the training, it does take approximately 2 weeks for the staff to get that training and is provided in a multiple methods and really a lot of hands-on practicing the protocol and shadowing staff as well that are the more experienced staff. Thank you. I will leave that back.
Thank you, Ms. Benson. Members, I wondered at this time if you have any questions for Ms. Benson at all, any clarifications? You must have done a great job. I'm curious about, did I miss it? You mentioned two of the rural sites, but the third one, where is that at? Within the cities?
Their headquarters is located in Bloomington, and so, and the call center staff, though, themselves are located in the Marshall and Hutchinson sites.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Right, thank you. Representative Baker.
Thanks, Madam Chair. A great overall view of this, I think, really well controlled system and a lot of quality controls. Appreciate that. 24/7 is the call center coverage. When do the calls come in? Do you ever see some late at night? Do you, I'm just kind of curious. Mm-hmm. So it, typically, I would think of it as coming in when you're, you know, either with your loved one and gosh, they just leave. And do you see them in the middle of the night at times too? I'm kind of curious. What are your trends, I guess, when the calls come in each day? You're getting about 85 calls a day, mm-hmm. 600 a week. That's 85. That's a lot of calls. And so that's alarming.
Ms. Benson?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker. We do see some trends where we are receiving calls. It's maybe a handful of calls during the night. They come in at any time, you know, through those 24 hours. But as you said, especially the fact that there are mandated reporters filing reports, those are oftentimes, you know, through the business hours, working hours. But we do see, you know, volume in the evening hours as well, and quite a bit of fluctuation over the days. So it's one where we very, very closely monitor that, and especially when the call center, you know, was first established, that, you know, we were adjusting service, staffing levels as a result to really make sure we have that capacity to take in the volume.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. Benson, I have one. I'm just curious about something. Just as we talk, something came to mind. I do know that there was a gentleman that was financially abused, and the bank recognized it. Do we ask financial institutions at all to report something if they suspect there's a problem?
Madam Chair, we have done a great deal of work in establishing partnerships in collaboration with the Department of Commerce and the financial institutions to encourage that reporting. The financial institutions are not mandated reporters, but we absolutely want to encourage them, and we do get reports from them. It's a work in progress, though, so we do trainings and awareness raising of, you know, financial institutions of staff, and they absolutely see it, and they want to be a part of, you know, this system or the network of folks who are looking for and able to respond.
Thank you. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Benson. I'm just curious. I have a feeling there's a lot of reporting that isn't happening. I mean, I'm hearing from different folks that I'm visiting with that, you know, oh, my parent, but they haven't filed a report. And in the coming years, I think we're going to kind of reach a peak. I mean, we talk about 2012, there's going to be more seniors than kids. So my question is, how do you feel you're staffed for the upcoming years? Do you think you'll have to include more staff, you know, do some more hiring? And it's hard to say what's going to happen, but I think there's a lot of unreported, some concerns that go unreported, but also with the coming, what we're hearing is going to happen. How do you feel you're situated right now?
Ms. Benson.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do think that there will be an increase in volume into the future. One of the reasons why we're monitoring our service levels so closely, of course, is to make sure we're doing a good job right here and now, but is really to see what are those trends. I mean, what will this look like, you know, over the next, you know, couple or few years? What will it look like in 2020, in 2025, and so on. And so we'll be monitoring that, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we do have to increase the staffing and do those types of things. And so what we're also looking for is anticipating that, you know, maybe the longer that we've got the experience of operating a call center, we'll see maybe are there efficiencies, you know, that we can gain in the process too. So we'll be, you know, watching for those if we can also meet that increased demand in that way too.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Benson, for being here, and I'm sure you'll be around to answer any other questions that may come up.
So. Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Members, we have Commissioner Jen Malcolm with us, and I welcome you. Come join us at the table, and we'd like to hear from you. Have an opportunity to introduce yourself. You've just been on the job a little while, so welcome, and would you introduce yourself, please?
Madam Chair, thank you. I am Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, Chair Keel, Representative Allen, and members of the committee. I appreciate this chance to come briefly this morning to introduce myself to this committee and to give you kind of my personal perspective on the critical work that's going on with the Office of Health Facility Complaints. Madam Chair, as you said, I've been on the job a month now. This time, I also had the privilege of serving in this role a number of years ago in the Ventura administration. And I will just say, you know, corny as it might sound, I fell in love with public health then, and I have I learned a lot in my prior term, and I've learned a great deal since then, including serving as the CEO of the Courage Center for 8 years, and then with Allina Health for an additional three, following the merger of Courage Center and Sister Kenny. So I bring to this particular issue a great deal of personal and professional passion. And I have said to many of our partners and all of our constituents that I am so deeply sorry for the problems that have been caused by the failures in the regulatory end of the system. I take that very seriously, as does the governor and as do all of our staff. I'm really happy to tell you that even though I'm the newest person into this work, the work that is going on to improve this system is real, and it's impressive. The partnership that we have with the Department of Human Services is invaluable. The experience that they bring in resolving system problems and workflow design, such as we've encountered with the buildup of this unacceptable backlog, has enabled us to make some rather remarkably swift progress in eliminating the backlog. We've got a team of the folks who are doing this work to give you an up-to-date briefing on that progress, but I just wanted to take the opportunity to tell you, as I've been briefed on the work plan and the process changes that are being made, I think this will serve the citizens of Minnesota much, much better. We do view this, what has happened, as completely unacceptable and as a failure in our systems that we completely own and will and are fixing. And we recognize that is our job to fix these systems and to restore the trust of people in Minnesota and the policymakers that represent them on these issues. And we're really, again, proud of the progress that's being made, and in no way does that lessen our responsibility and our apology to the people of Minnesota for our failure to do everything we could early enough to strengthen the system, which clearly has had a lot of problems over the years, failing to modernize the technology and keep pace with the staffing and keep pace with the workflows. So that is all very, very much on us. We, as I mentioned, this extraordinary interagency partnership is helping us to really make rapid progress to fix this part of the system. We have more work to do to complete, to eliminate the remaining backlog, which is already impressively reduced, and to build a robust system that's going to better serve Minnesotans going forward. And we are just, I can't emphasize enough how committed the governor is. I am, as commissioner, and really most importantly, the staff who do this work, who really, really care about the work they do. And I have to tell you, I told them, the staff that are doing this work, that I think we owe them an apology as well for our failure to have the systems in place that can support the work they do, because they are deeply committed to their work and to the mission of protecting vulnerable adults in Minnesota. So we're well aware of all of the issues facing you in this short session and the complexity of your workload, but we really appreciate the time that you are giving and will give to working with us, not only to improve issues related to our agency's performance of our regulatory duties, but also the broader policy issues that this has raised in the minds of all citizens, the visibility that has been brought to the whole situation of the kind of care and protections that do or don't exist for elders and other vulnerable adults in our state. And that, so that broader set of policy issues, I think, absolutely merits your attention and our collective work. As I know you're aware, Governor Dayton asked for an independent consumer work group to be convened and kind of coordinated and supported by the AARP, and they released quite a thoughtful and detailed report in late January that I hope you will give consideration to some of their policy recommendations as well. Just want to reinforce again how committed our agency is and our partner agencies in working with you to improve this system. And ultimately, not only to fix the regulatory end of the system, but to do much, much more to prevent, to use all the tools in our toolbox to prevent issues of elder and vulnerable adult maltreatment in our state. There's lots and lots of opportunity here for improvement. So I also know and believe, and we are working with and talking with the long-term care industry to support and encourage and, frankly, require them to also do what they can do to assure that when issues happen in care facilities, that the providers of that care are held appropriately responsible as well. I'm happy to answer any questions you have of me personally, but in light of your time, I'm sure you'd like to hear from the experts who are actually doing the work. Thanks so much for this time.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions of Commissioner Malcolm? There probably will be discussion in the future. So
absolutely.
Thank you very much for joining us.
I'd like to call up now from
what you'll see?
Yep, from MDH, our Assistant Commissioner Acevedo, and I believe DHS's Inspector General Carolyn Hamm is here as well, I believe.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, we have, as the Commission mentioned, Carolyn Hamm, the Inspector General from the Department of Human Services, and Mr. Gil Acevedo. I had to work on that name. I could say Gil long before I could say Acevedo. Anyway, thank you for joining us. Is Dan Pollack going to join us too, or I wasn't sure if he was.
He's here.
All right.
All right.
Thank you for joining us. If I don't know which one of you wants to introduce yourself first and go first.
I will start. So, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carolyn Hamm. I am the new Inspector General for the Department of Human Services. I've been in this position almost a year, but it's been quite a learning experience for sure. I wanted to just give you a little bit of my background so you can understand where I come from in terms of approaching the work that we do. I did have over 10 years with the Attorney General's Office doing prosecutions of various kinds of fraud, consumer fraud, banking fraud, that sort of thing. But in the last decade or so, I was actually at Optum, subsidiary of United Health Group, assisting in their anti-fraud work. So I'm very familiar with business processes and how we can make things run more smoothly, et cetera. So you've heard, I'm sure, of the crisis that led to DHS being asked to step into this situation to help. And I guess I wanted to just say, well, you know, why DHS? Why did we come in? And there were a couple of reasons, and I want to highlight them. One is We have an Office of Continuous Improvement, and I think I cannot speak highly enough of this office, because they really are, their goal is to help our agency figure out how we can do our work more efficiently, more quickly, and really streamline our process. And so the Office of Inspector General actually had a partnership with the Office of Continuous Improvement back in 2014 when we had a similar problem with our maltreatment investigations. You saw that some of the MARC reports come to DHS. We had a backlog, not to the degree that OHSC does, but we had a backlog. And we were able to work with the OHSC, or the Office of Continuous Improvement, to get rid of that backlog and to keep current. Of course, that's the key. You can put in a bunch of resources, get rid of a backlog, but if you haven't changed the processes, you'll have a backlog in a very short time. So we were able to do that with the Office of Continuous Improvement. So it made sense for us to come in and help. We have five very experienced senior staff from the Office of Inspector General that are working very closely with Gil and his team to make sure that we can be giving the coaching, the lessons learned, and really help in this process. And so the reason that Gil and I are up here together is because this really is a collaboration. This is not DHS coming in and saying this is what you're going to do, because that is not how a continuous improvement process works. Continuous improvement process has to have input from the people who are doing the work. And so what we started out to begin with is we created a core team. This core team consisted of members of the Continuous Improvement Office, members of the DHS OIG, but then also key members of the OHSC, because they're the ones who are doing the work and they know the pain points. So we created this core team. They then did a process which is called mapping the as-is process. So what are we doing right now? And believe me, it was not pretty at all. So what they do is they look at every handoff that happens, how much, where are delays, and really just look at, you know, in a very clinical way, what's going on and where are delays happening. And so because of that, we were able to identify that there were lots of backlogs in every spot, whether it was the intake, writing the reports, whatever, there were backlogs. So once we had an idea of what the issues were, then we had to figure out, well, what will work better? We've got to look at this differently. And so, again, the core team, all members, worked out, and we created our to-be process, which is, what will make much more sense? What will reduce these backlogs, rework, bottlenecks? And we were able to, in large part, use many of the processes that the OIG has for maltreatment investigations, because our work is very, very similar. There are certain key aspects that are very different with regard to interactions with CMS, but we were able to use many of the processes that we already had. So that has helped a lot. So then once we had charted what was going on, how we wanted to do it, then we began the task of tackling these backlogs. And you have the, I think you have this sheet here that has the very impressive statistics in terms of where it's gone. But just to briefly go through it, so we broke the backlogs down into two different backlogs. One is when the complaint comes in, the report comes in, we had a backlog. OHSC had a considerable backlog, and we wanted to focus on that first because we wanted to make sure there were no reports in there that needed immediate attention, and so we quickly began work on that backlog. We also then identified, well, where are, under the statute, the reports should be completed in 60 days. OHSC has not been meeting that. So we wanted to look at where are those backlogs and what's causing that. So what you can see is that if you take both of those backlogs, we've gone from 3,147 down to 540. And that's really in just a couple of, maybe a month. And that may seem extraordinary, that may seem suspicious, but I can tell you that some of that is just simply due to data entry. So the OHSC has a system that you were supposed to record all the cases that came in, all the reports, and then they are to be closed out. Well, some of them simply weren't closed out. And so some of these dramatic drops that you see here was just due to, all right, we've got to clean up, we've got to get our data to be have integrity. And so once we were able to go through and identify this has been closed, it just hadn't had the piece, hit the button to say closed. So some of that occurred there. But in the backlog, the triage backlog, another piece was that was missing is that there was not a standardized decision-making process in place. So there were a lot of people, a lot of time spent trying to decide, does this warrant investigation, does this not warrant investigation? And that's where the OIG was really able to provide, lend their expertise to say, in our experience, we have a standardized decision-making. We look at the risk factors and we figure out, should this go for an off-site or not, an on-site investigation or not. And so just getting some of that consistency and standardization allowed people to get through their work much more quickly. So I want to talk just a little bit, and Gil and I are going to go back and forth on this one a little bit, of just some of the basic things that we've put into place just to give you a sense of how we were able to make such progress. And again, the progress, it can be small little things that save 5 minutes, it could be things that save 3 days. So we've got everything's on the table, and we're trying it all. So as I said, one of the key things we did was to create some standardized work processes so that people know exactly what they're supposed to do when they get a piece of paper, how they should be dealing with it. And again, this was created in collaboration with the OHSC. This was not DHS coming down and saying, this is what you're going to do. This was a collaborative process. Another key was to make sure that people are using the existing data that we had so that they don't forget to close out a case when it's closed, so that we can actually have trust that we have integrity in our data. Another thing that we were able to do was we were able to get the department or OHSC access to the SSIS system, and that enabled us for them to more quickly determine, is this a case they have jurisdiction over? As you saw from Ms. Benson's presentation, there are various agencies or the counties that should be investigating these. Well, sometimes it can be unclear whose jurisdiction this is, and so by getting access, getting the staff access to the SSIS, they're more quickly able to figure out, oh, this, you know what, this is not one of our cases. This actually should go to the county, or this should go to DHS. So that was just a small piece that we were able to do. Another example where a simple change but dramatic reduction in the amount of time was when the reports come in, oftentimes they may need more information. And so the triage staff will ask for more information from the provider. Maybe they need medical records. Well, the OHSC was sending out a certified or a letter FedEx asking for medical records. That would take a day or so. Then they'd get the medical records back. Then they'd determine whether or not the case should proceed. Now we have secure email that they're able to send the request for the records out by email, but in a secure fashion. The providers can provide it back electronically if they wish. We've just cut out several days, and we've also cut out, now we don't have a piece of paper that's going to come in that we're now going to have to scan and put into the system. So a lot of the changes are really focusing on trying to get rid of the paper so that we can streamline the process and really get down to the important work that the staff are doing. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Gil.
Mr. Acevedo, will you please identify yourself for the record?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gil Acevedo. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Health. I oversee the Health Systems Bureau, which has health regulation, health policy, and the Office of Medical Cannabis. Thank you for allowing us to speak this morning and giving us the opportunity to give you an update on the Office of Health Facilities Complaint and the Interagency Agreement Partnership with the Department of Human Services. As Inspector General Ham mentioned, there's been a lot of work, and our Commissioner also mentioned there's been a lot of work, and I feel a lot of great work being done in this partnership as well. I just want to mention a few things on the front end. The Office of Health Facilities Complaint is part of the Health Regulation Division, and the Health Regulation Division regulates a number of different industries within Minnesota. We range from mortuary science, body art, nursing homes, hospitals. Office of Health Facilities Complaints receives complaints of hospitals, nursing homes, assisted living, home care type of areas. Part of the improvements has been technology. We've been known, and you've heard many times, that we've had a paper process, and Chair Keel came down and toured the health facilities complaint area, and I know that you saw the piles of papers that we had as part of our paper process. So we're adding a technology component to this. The continuous improvement team, along with the Office of the Inspector General, has helped us look at tools that we already have, tools such as SharePoint. SharePoint is an opportunity for us to take our workflow and use paper that would, files that would normally come in, and we would print them and just move them from our intake through triage and have it waiting for investigators to look at. The SharePoint is only a temporary fix. That's something that we're using right now to eliminate our paper, our reliance on paper. As of last week, our intake and triage area has gone paperless. So this is very impressive work. The recommendations and the tools, the training that's being done of our staff through the Office of Continuous Improvement and the Office of the Inspector General has been nothing but impressive when it comes to that area. One of the things that we're looking to do, I said that SharePoint is a temporary fix, is that we're looking at another system, which is a electronic document management system. This electronic document management system, what it does is it takes in the files that come in, and then it actually catalogs it and moves it through the system, places it in queues so that individuals that need to look at the document next, it's there waiting for them. Again, it reduces the ability for us to have to print papers and moves the system more efficiently through the system. Now we can actually go in, since it's catalog, and pull up information based on either the name of an individual or a file number, as an example. So that'll eliminate a lot of duplication and wasted time. As Ms. Benson was mentioning, the MARC system has that database that we use, and we have currently where calls come into the MARC and they get referred over to our intake. We are working with the MARC system, both DHS and MDH, working with MARC to look at ways that we can improve our process. Prior to our conversation right now, we had a dual reporting system. A nursing home that's required, that's certified by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, was required to report directly to MDH, and then it would be reported to MARC so that we can track it that way as well. And then individuals reporting cases would report it through the MARC. Now we've got a dual track system that creates inefficiencies and duplication. We reached out, MDH reached out to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services in 2015, asked to use a single point of entry by using MARC. They denied our request. Here recently, we reached back out to CMS and explained the efficiencies that we're putting in place and that this would be a duplicative system and create some problems for us and the citizens of Minnesota, and they approved a single point of entry for us. There's some work that needs to be done, and we're working on those issues right now. There's been some talk about a case management system. So I've talked about perceptive content and SharePoint. That can only take us up to a certain point. A case management system now takes us into the investigator's world and being able to track a lot of the work that's being done through an electronic process. That conversation we have placed on hold to have a more robust conversation with the legislature at some point during this session. So at this point, we have not made a decision on a case management system. One of the things that the Office of Continuous Improvement has done to really help improve how we're doing business is increase in communication to the staff, letting everyone know what is going on in, at all different areas. We're attacking different pieces of the work all at one time. And so the staff have done a number of things to improve communication. One thing is they started a staff newsletter. This newsletter keeps updates on where we are in this process and what we're doing to improve. We're having monthly staff meetings that we are giving updates on where we are. One-on-one meetings with staff. So in each individual person, we're doing not only training with the individual person, but we're having these one-on-one meetings to make sure they understand the importance of the work we're doing. And because things are moving and changing so rapidly, we want to make sure that they're on top of everything as things change. We're working with CMS to have a better understanding of the clarification of the questions that we've asked and the expectations on all the federal work that's being done there. We are also, most importantly, we're sending letters and emails to family members that are caught up in this backlog. At the beginning, as Carolyn mentioned, we had that the backlog where we had over 3,000. We started sending letters to them immediately, letting them know, first of all, we apologize for the delay, we apologize for the backlog, and that we're moving through these, and these are the things that they can expect from us. One of the things that we've pointed out was who to contact if they needed to get in contact with the Ombudsman's Office, they needed to contact us at the Department of Health, they can always contact the Office of Inspector General as well, and if they feel that there is an issue of concern, they can always contact law enforcement as well. So that has gone on. This is ongoing. We're sending these letters, improving that communication with family members and individuals that have reported cases to us. We're doing a lot of training of triage staff to better communicate with family, how to speak to families about the issues that they're finding or that we're finding. And then finally, one of the things that we have really spent a lot of time on is improving our letters to family members and facilities. We have a large number of letters, and each letter is kind of different, and they really don't tell you much. And so we want to make sure that as we're communicating to family members upon completion of the case, through the process of the case, that we're doing this in a way that is plain English and makes sense to the individual that's receiving the letter. We're, one of the big parts of our continuous improvement process is space redesign. We have these high wall cubicles and people can just kind of hide in their cubicles and you have no engagement, no communication. And one of the things that we're looking at is to improve the flow of communication so that there is collaboration. So you can have that person next to you if you have questions, how you deal with these issues one-on-one. So we're also looking at our space design. We don't use good use of natural light. Again, the cubicles are so high, and it just seems kind of dark in that area. So, Dan, if you... I'd like to, again, thank the committee. This has been a lot of work, a lot of fast and furious work, much needed work, very important work. I, again, want to thank the legislature for last year, for last session, providing some funding for the Office of Health Facilities Complaint and the attention that not only the governor and our staff but also the legislature and the citizens have placed towards this very important area. So with that, if there are any questions.
Thank you. Members, do you have questions of any of the testifiers? Representative Baker?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just can't help to compliment you guys on your customer service skills. I know that it wasn't great when you took over, especially when the new commissioner took over, and there was a lot of bumps there, but it's refreshing to know that you immediately took action and you owned it, you apologized, and I didn't see that from our colleagues over in Minlars. And it's been so frustrating that there are some agencies that actually can do the right thing and to say we didn't do the very good job, but we're getting on it. So I just want to say thank you for your work. I look forward to hearing more of the report down the road, but at least you owned it, and you're doing the right thing now. So if, on behalf of a lot of our citizens, thank you for your work on this.
Any comments?
Okay. No. Thank you, Representative Baker. Okay. I really do appreciate that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say the same, that I think what brought us to this is unfortunate, and I appreciate the spirit of how we're having this conversation that's around how do we move forward so these problems don't continue on. I think a lot of time we spend time looking at a problem and a lot less around solutions, and so it's refreshing to be in an environment that's solution-focused, and I appreciate that in what you're doing. It'll feel odd when we step back in time then, and we're going to go deep down on the problem again next week. And so I just want to say in this moment, I'm hearing you taking the steps, and it's noticed, it's appreciated, and I wish that we would spend as much time on solutions as you are, and I just hope this body and this committee is used to be a solution-focused place, and I look forward to hearing more from you and just want to say that I appreciate you coming forward and sharing the work you've done.
Thank you. Mr. Acevedo.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, thank you very much. I do want to say that there's been a lot of criticism of the Office of Health Facilities complaint, and as our commissioner said, you know, we own that, and we're not shying away from the responsibility that we have for the work that we do. When the Office of the Legislative Auditor report does come out, obviously, the department will be up in explaining our work that we're doing towards improvement as well. But I think, you know, as things became more and more public, and it was in the media, and you know, we were constantly trying to do the right thing. And as our commissioner said, our staff, you know, I publicly apologize to the staff as well. When you look at the as-is process, which is our current state, and you see the chaos that they were in, but yet they were trying to do the right thing, that was not a healthy work environment to place our employees in. And so the morale is high now. People are feeling energized. They feel they come to work, and they see the light at the end of the tunnel here because they're actually seeing things happen, and we're doing it for all the right reasons, for the vulnerable adults and the citizens of Minnesota.
I thank you. I'm sure that load was pretty heavy because it's not a fun thing to listen to every day anyway, and see the reports, which is the other, as you mentioned, Representative Olson, the other thing we have to deal with is lessening the reports in general. So very important. Any other questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much. I look forward to more conversation from both of you. And I believe we have, is it Deputy Commissioner Santo Cruz coming up? Oh, and Deputy Commissioner Pollack, are you going to join us still?
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Santo Cruz. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I oversee a number of areas, but the one that brings me here today is I oversee the Office of the Inspector General.
Madam Chair, Dan Pollack, Deputy Commissioner for Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we provided today a copy of the interagency agreement that we executed before starting our work in earnest. And really, I think what you'll find as you read through that, as an attorney, I love whereas clauses, but they are something that doesn't really, it's not a plain language document, let's say that. And if you kind of follow the labyrinthine whereases of all of the different statutes that are cited, eventually you're going to get to page 2. And that's really where the rubber hits the road. That's really where we get the partnership from. You'll see a language that talks about some real responsibility taken on by the Department of Human Services. And that is that was in service of really two things. One was we had been in a similar situation before, and we knew how painful it was to get out of it. And so knowing what needed to be done, we didn't want to see ourselves as some type of consultant or suggestion box of, well, you could do this, you could do that, but, you know, you do you, MDH. No, this was very much we wanted a partnership, we wanted responsibility, because we felt we really had the expertise to make things better. And I hope that the backlog, clearing out of the backlog of investigations and triage reports, I hope that that bears it out and shows that we really have had an effect in our time at MDH. The second reason was because in order to really have that partnership and go in and knowing that there was going to be difficult conversations and decisions that had to be made, we wanted to make sure that we ourselves were taking responsibility for our own decisions and actions. If we were going to be saying to another agency, this is the way you ought to be doing it, it wouldn't be as though if we would not have had an agreement in place that we could have owned our own decisions. And interagency agreements agree at different levels all around state government. I remember from my time at AG, actually, we shared a lab with the Department of Health. So the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, share one building that is the state kind of top lab for the state. MDH had their floors, Department of Ag had their floors, but we had a lot of interagency agreements around certain equipment that wasn't efficient to buy in duplicate and triplicate. And so that's the other kind of ancillary benefit to having this interagency agreement is rather than hiring out or hiring up a bunch of people that they would need to train in order to do this work, we already do the work, we already have the expertise, we work with the exact same statute, just in different physical settings around the state. So we know how the law is applied, we know how triage should be done, and so we're uniquely qualified to provide some efficiency in getting things taken care of right away. Obviously, we don't contemplate ourselves being there indefinitely, and we are there to hand the baton back after the expertise and processes are in place. But that was the view and the purpose behind the interagency agreement. And I turn it over to Dan if he has something else there.
Mr. Pollack?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I really don't have a lot to add. I feel really good about the work that's been done. I think it's borne out by the dashboard metrics that you see in front of you. Interagency agreements are a really important part of agency management because not every agency knows the best way to accomplish every project or every idea. And so while I recognize and respect the legislature's prerogative to look at these and question or talk about them with us, I would encourage you to support them. I think this is actually a great example of the kind of interagency agreement that could be used in other spaces and other agencies when an agency finds itself in a crisis. The procurement process that it would have taken to hire an outside consultant or an outside team of professionals to come in and do what Deputy Commissioner Cruz's staff have done in the last 3 months would have taken us probably 6 months to go from start to finish a procurement and awarding a contract in an actual sort of outside bid process. So it is really important. I think, going forward, as you heard from Assistant Commissioner Acevedo and Inspector General Carolyn Hamm, there's going to be additional decision-making steps along the way. I think the next big one is really the case management system, and that really is about how do we replace the unfortunately named Paradise system. It is a legacy system from the 1990s. I know I look young, but I was in high school when it was built. And
you don't look that young.
Yeah, thanks. Well, I looked younger a couple months ago. And Madam Chair, we do need to get out of that platform. And it does affect multiple sections and areas of the Health Regulation Division, not just OHFC. So we would really appreciate timely input from the legislature about, ways to approach that. We are going to be looking at doing a request for information in April to try to get ideas and feedback from the private sector in terms of what options may be out there. But this is a big project, and I'm sure you're tired of hearing it. It will be an expensive IT project, and so we do need to work collaboratively with you on that. And I would really appreciate the feedback during this session on that issue.
Well, I'll make this comment because it's in the air, but whatever we decide to do, we need to make sure that the IT system we look for and set up is much more successful than our past, because we don't need a backlog of people injured, hurt, not addressed. So anyway, that's something to think about. Who best should be helping us to set up an appropriate system. So, Representative Baker.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. And gentlemen, good work on this too. Two comments I guess I have is, who sort of instigated the interagency collaboration? Was it you, Dan, to kind of get that going because you needed help, or was it just others to say this is quicker, faster, and better because our team is already here? Good idea on that. So yeah, who actually kind of started this discussion?
Mr. Pollack?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker. Actually, I think the governor asked the agencies to work together on this back in, I want to say, November. It took a little while to get the details worked out, and I think as some of the articles were coming out, we started taking it a lot more seriously. So I don't want to necessarily give credit to anybody specifically. I mean, we worked together on this language, and I think, I don't know, maybe you heard my joke in the Senate. It was kind of like eating your kale because it didn't taste great, but I think it was the right decision.
And that ensured they're healthier because of it, so I think the kale turned out pretty well. And then finally, you know, you mentioned the IT system that's going to have to be looked at. I certainly invite that to come in front of our committee, the Select Technology Committee with Government Responsiveness, that has been overwhelmed with MNLARS. But we need to look ahead of that. We need to look at what is the next system that we are pretty certain, you know, MNIT's not going to write again, but we know that they have to be there to support it and to help us design and develop this. But we just need to make sure that we can do another system that will pay good dividends in the future. So I invite you to do that at the future time. Thank you.
Any other members have questions, comments? I think. Oh, yes, Representative Freiberg.
I guess this was more for you, Madam Chair. I just, you know, going forward here, I see we're meeting. We have a joint meeting with the Health Reform Committee on Tuesday to talk about the Legislative Auditor's Report. We're meeting again next Wednesday. I guess I'm just wondering: is it your intention to have an? You know, these meetings have been are interesting. Is it your intention to have a meeting where we go over the AARP Working Group report and their recommendations as well? I think it would be helpful to have somebody who was involved in that process.
A plan, yes. And in fact, we do. We unfortunately will not have, because of the short session, we will not have a lot of time. And that is what's really challenging with all of this. But I wanted to make sure I was aware of the fact that the department, Minnesota Department of Health, was already working on this before the news release, but obviously we were not moving it fast enough, and we needed to, as a committee, hear what was going on. So I wanted them to explain where they were at and where they were going, and I knew that they had already started working on some changes that they could address within their office, which we heard in regard to. But yes, we have. I really want to hear the OLA's report before we start doing any deep dives, and we'll hear from the providers and the consumers, AARP, and hear their proposals, and they're going to come to one of our meetings. We may end up having to, any bills we pass may have to just go through health HHS policy instead of us, just because of timing, and of course deadlines came out, so we've got a brick wall coming, and so we need to make sure that we've addressed this. I mean, it's a very important issue, not just from the end of the offices and how they deal with the reports, but the fact that we're having reports at all, the fact that we need to make sure that anybody that is vulnerable is protected, and we do not want to see people being injured. Unfortunately, human nature is that happens, so we need to make sure we stop it. But I'd like to see us stop it long before it hits the department, so that they don't have those huge or even those the calls that you have. Obviously, they're always going to happen, but yes. So does that explain a little bit where we're headed?
I think so. Okay. Do you have a, I mean, would that be next Wednesday that we might hear about that, or the following week? Or
yes, yeah, the intent is obviously the OLA report on Tuesday morning, so I'm hoping everyone's here. That's a joint report, so we'll be able to ask them questions. And then the consumers will talk to, or the providers will talk to on Wednesday, the 7th of March, and then the 14th we should be able to hear from the consumers. And I have been in contact with them, and I hope they're
seeing all of you and explaining what they're offering. I think people need to remember that this is very challenging and very difficult to make sure that we provide safety for people, citizens, but we also provide privacy and their right to express what it is they want. I find this interesting. My father listened to the reports on the Senate committee the other day. My parents are aging. We're discussing how long they live in the house they're in. And he told me he could only handle about half of it. And he was letting me know that it was very important to him that we do something about this also. I think he's hoping he can move in with me. Maybe not. I might be too much for him. Anyway, so Representative Allen, did you have...
Thank you, Madam Chair, for laying out a roadmap for the work of the committee here. And so just to clarify, as far as hearing any bills, you said there might not be enough time that they might be heard in the larger committee, but will you be making a decision on that, or are you still open to hearing bills, or?
Yes, Representative Allen, what I'm hoping we can do is talk to each of those groups. They have bills that are their proposals. As you know, the consumers have come forward some recommendations, and we'll address those at that time when they... on the 7th and the 14th when they come into the committee. So I'm hoping that we can talk to each of those groups on their recommendations and hear from them. Part of the problem is that also the bills are not quite ready yet, so when they get dropped, and that's kind of, if we're ready before, we'll certainly hear them here, but... I've talked to Chair Schumacher, too, so he's aware of this. And they do have to flow from our committee to the Health and Human Services policies. So just have to make sure that all of this gets handled in the appropriate time. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Both of you gentlemen. Appreciate it. I guess we're where we were at. I was thinking we had more to talk about, but you all know about the importance of the Tuesday meeting. We're going to hear from the Office of Legislative Auditor and hear their assessment of the examination of the situation, and then March 7th. So with that, I guess we are done for the day. So thank you very much. See you next Tuesday. Well, see you tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.